do we exist? Were we created with a purpose, or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. Join us as we seek to see a generation captivated and transformed by the truth of Christianity. This is The Universe Next Door.
Welcome to The Universe Next Door. We're back to our series, Are You Sure You Know What That Verse Means? 2 weeks ago, we covered, or at least touched on, the Tower of Babel when I did a response video. And by the way, a lot of people, either through email or telling me in person or whatever, certainly noticed how rude that lady was in her video. And I linked her YouTube page in the description. She has all of her videos are like that I've seen at least. And it wasn't only the crudeness and the sort of like the arrogance that bothered me. It was just as much the bad arguments. It's like, if you're going to be arrogant, at least have a good argument. And the arguments were just embarrassing. So I'll link that in the description below. If you haven't seen that yet, check it out, because it will, first of all, help you understand more about the Tower of Babel in the actual story. We miss a whole lot of it, and we'll probably come back to Babel again. But in addition to that, it's also important that we realize there are people who talk about the faith this way, the Christian faith, and we have to be able to respond patiently, but also wisely and discerningly. And it's easy to get frustrated, but I've seen this a lot in the deconstructionist movement. You see bad arguments, and they're said very confidently, and this gives people the impression that they're true until you come forward and dismantle it and just show that it's kind of a joke. So make sure you go check that out when you get a chance. But we're continuing our series with part two today, and today we're going to be talking about the promise to Abram in Genesis 15 and what that promise actually means and maybe doesn't mean. There's a popular interpretation today, but there seems to have been a different interpretation in ancient Judaism, especially during Second Temple period literature, possibly the New Testament, and even Bible authors in the Old Testament like Jeremiah. So we're going to be looking at an interesting take on the promise to Abram in Genesis 15:5, of course, repeated several times throughout Genesis. But we're going to be looking at a very interesting take. And my goal for this series is not to tell you what these verses mean and you have to drop whatever you thought. First of all, a lot of the time, the interpretation you may have of a verse, it doesn't mean that it's canceled out. Sometimes there's just more to a verse. Sometimes there are just layers of it we didn't realize or understand. But second of all, as I always say, can you prove your view to yourself? If you have a specific take on a passage, can you demonstrate it to yourself scripturally? And can you cover all the bases? Can you take everything into account, not sort of just the things that are convenient for a theological framework, while leaving out all of the things that are inconvenient and might cause a problem for your theological view? So if your thought is, Nick, this interpretation sounds crazy, okay. But you have to be able to say why. You can't just say something sounds crazy because it isn't what you're used to. But before we get started, make sure you hit follow and notify so that you're notified of new episodes. I've had a number of people tell me that things were going on with Apple. Either episodes weren't coming up or it was saying temporarily unavailable or something like that. So hopefully that's resolved. We'll see. But just make sure you hit follow and notify so you keep up with new episodes coming out. And also, if you find this episode helpful or any other episode, be sure to share it with a friend. That is by far the best way to spread what we are doing here. And we want to see people equipped to defend the gospel, to understand the gospel. You can't defend what you don't understand. And so that's really our main goal here. If you would share an episode with a friend, that would go a very long way. So thank you so much for doing that. Well, with that being said, let's get started on the topic here. So let's go over to Genesis 15:5. We'll start by just reading the promise from Genesis 15, and then we'll go over to see how the Apostle Paul uses it in Romans 4, because it's very important to see how the New Testament authors are interpreting this promise. And Paul has there's some interesting things going on here. So there might be more to this than you thought there was. Genesis 15:5 says, God, he took him outside and said, look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. So here's the first time we see this promise to Abram. about his descendants. God says, look up at all the stars, if you can even count them. He says, so shall your offspring be. So this is the initial promise to Abram. Before we go over to Romans 4 now, the common view of this promise is quantitative. In other words, it has to do with how many. So when God says, look up and count the stars, the idea is that, well, there are a lot of stars, so that means you will have a lot of descendants. That's the modern interpretation today, at least in a nutshell. So we're going to be looking at how there might be much more to it, and how there might actually be something here where it isn't just numerical, it isn't just quantitative, that your descendants will be a lot, but it's also qualitative when he says your descendants will be as the stars in heaven, when we're going to see in just a moment here. So that's Genesis 15:5. That's the original promise. Now let's go over to Romans 4 and look at how Paul interprets and applies this promise. So this is in Romans 4, chapter 8, I'm sorry, verse 18. He says, against all hope, Abraham in hope believed, and so became the father of many nations. Just as it had been said, so shall your offspring be. And Paul here, as New Testament authors do about three quarters of the time, is quoting, he's pulling this promise from the Septuagint, which of course was the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So he pulls this from the Septuagint, and the Septuagint says, so shall your seed be, rather than just so shall your offspring be. And so to get a little bit more clarity, and we can see this promise sort of expanded a little bit, let's look at the different ways it's used in the book of Genesis, because of course this promise is retold several times, the next one being in Genesis 17. So let's go to Genesis 17:5, where he says, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. So the question is, what does this mean? And remember, it's of course, you have the nation of Israel who comes directly from Abram, but the whole point is that after Babel, when the nations were disinherited, God now creates his own nation using Abram, who's now Abraham, and he's drawing all of the nations back to himself. And of course, we see, at least depending on your view, the beginning of the culmination of this when Christ comes back. And you have theological messaging all over the New Testament in regard to this. We've covered that in a number of episodes, and we'll continue to cover it. But you have this idea of all of the nations being blessed through Abram. So that's Genesis 17:5. He says, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. So what does it mean for Abraham to be the father of a multitude of nations? Now let's go over to the next time it's used, and this is going to give us a little bit more expansion here, a little bit more of an understanding. This is going to be from Genesis 22, verse 17. Actually, we can back up to verse 16 just because this is, or 15 just because this is important, because we see that the angel of the Lord is God. So let's start at verse 15. It says, and the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and not withheld your son, your only son. So let's pause. That's just to clarify for anybody who may not know and is new to the show, or any show for that matter. The angel of the Lord is God. My view, and probably the prominent evangelical view, is that the angel of the Lord is specifically the person of Jesus Christ, pre-incarnate. So that's story for another day, but there you go. Angel of the Lord is God, undisputed. Verse 17, this is where the promise comes in. I will surely bless you and will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So notice the language used here. God tells him, I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and as the sand that is on the seashore. So one would presume that the sand on the seashore is numerical, but the question is, what does it mean for Abraham to have his offspring or his seed multiplied as the stars of heaven? Now, if you remember, we did an episode recently on how the Israelites viewed the stars. And it seems that the Israelites had viewed the stars as, first of all, they had a whole different view of cosmology. They believed that the earth was sort of a flat disk, that underneath the actual earth, there was not only water, but now you have the deep, deep water underneath the whole form of the earth, or the whole form of the land. So you have like earth as this ground level. Underneath it, you have Sheol, or the place of the dead. Of course, some differing views on exactly what that is or what it's described as, but you have Sheol, and then under that you have another layer of water called the deep. Now, when you look up, what they would have thought they were seeing is basically this dome. And in the book of Job, in Job 38, this dome, they believe there was a solid dome around the earth. This dome is actually described as metal in the book of Job. That's how they understood it, as a solid dome. Even in Genesis, in the creation narrative of Genesis 1, you have the term rakia used to describe what's often now translated as the expanse, but there's really no refutation of this being a solid dome. In fact, I've even seen responses from people and answers in Genesis, and their arguments are basically, well, they didn't have the word for it, so they just used what they had. It's like, if we're going to do that, we can pretty much just manipulate every word of the Bible. If we think God gave them this special revelation in regard to science, but couldn't give them a new word for it, I don't think that's a very good argument. And not to mention that the Bible is not intended to be a science book. So all that to say, they viewed this, what you see in the sky, they thought was a solid dome. And then beyond that dome are the heavens, where God lives and where God dwells. So when they looked up and they saw these stars, they had no idea that these were fiery gas balls. This was not a view in ancient astronomy. It didn't exist. I mean, people didn't even know this stuff until like 700 years ago. Not even, less than that. I'm not great with math. What? Yeah, 500 or 600 years ago. This was not common knowledge back then. They had no idea. And so when they viewed these stars, the ancient Near Eastern cultures, all of Israel's neighbors, they very clearly thought that the stars were alive. They thought that they were spiritual beings, and we see the same thing echoed in Scripture. So not only do you see these ideas not refuted in Scripture, but you also see them echoed and repeated because they shared the same understanding. And God, of course, used them where they were in their understanding, just like He uses us in our understanding of how the world works. You know, in 200 years from now, if we're still here, science is probably going to look a lot different than it does now. And our understanding of things is going to look a lot different. So we shouldn't expect any different from people 4,000 years ago. But with that being said, this was their understanding of the layout. They thought that stars were angelic beings. And you can see many passages, like in Deuteronomy 4, for example, Deuteronomy 4:19, and then I believe in Deuteronomy 17, where they view the stars as angelic hosts, as heavenly hosts, as spiritual beings. I mean, stars light up, they move, they have quote-unquote glory. We see that all throughout the Bible. And so, well, the stars must be alive. They must be spiritual beings. So the question is, what does it mean to have Abraham's descendants be made as the stars in heaven? And this is where we would have to get into the topic of what an evangelical would refer to as glorification. What does it mean to be glorified in heaven? What does it mean in 2 Peter 1 when we are told that we are partakers in the divine nature? You know, these are questions that have to be responded to, even if they make us uncomfortable, and even if we're not used to maybe dealing with this stuff and hearing this stuff. It's in the Bible, and somebody will bring it up to you, and you won't know what to say, and it's going to be awkward. So it's better to just be prepared. But here is the question in Genesis 22:17: what does it mean to be multiplied as the stars of heaven? So again, the common view is quantitative, that it has to do with number, it has to do with how many. But what we're looking at today is a view that is qualitative. Okay, qualitative, meaning it has to do with quality. It has to do with what we will be made into rather than how many there of us there will be, believers, that is. And so, again, the majority view, quantitative, but this episode is about the qualitative view. What does it mean to be made as the stars in heaven? So we're going to look at some interpretations, some early Jewish interpretations, and possibly even Bible authors who interpreted it this way, including Paul. Is this promise meant to be something more than quantitative? Even in the early church, you know, the early church father Athanasius had a famous quote where he said, God became man so that we might become God. Now, remember, this is not Mormonism. Mormonism erases the creator-creation distinction, and I think we have to be careful not to do that, of course. But what does it mean to be glorified? What does it mean to be as the stars in heaven? What does it mean to be partakers in the divine nature? So these are things that we have to tackle, that we have to have a view on, because these are things that are clearly in the Bible. So let's look at one more usage in the book of Genesis before we start to break this down a little more. And this one's going to be from Genesis 26. And this is I'm reading from the ESV right now. I think they usually get this stuff pretty good. But this is from Genesis 26, and this is verse 4, where it says, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all of these lands. And in your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So again, we see this, I'll multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all of the nations would be blessed through this. So now that we have an idea here of what the promise actually is, and we're going to examine how Paul uses it here, but first let's look at how Jews in the Second Temple period, at least some prominent ones, had understood this passage, and that'll of course help us get to what Paul is doing with it. But how did they understand this passage? Like I said, today, in modern times, the prominent view, the most popular view, is that this is numerical. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that's probably the only view that you've heard. But this wasn't the case during the Second Temple period, which was the period in between the Old and New Testament. Technically, it extended a little bit into New Testament times until the temple was destroyed, but this is also referred to as the intertestamental period between the Old and New. But usually when you're reading scholarly work of any kind, it's going to use the more proper term, which is Second Temple literature. That was the time of the Second Temple. You had the First Temple, which was, you know, destroyed, and then they rebuilt it. You see that in Ezra and Nehemiah. And the Second Temple goes until 70 AD when it's destroyed as well. So let's look at how Philo, in his writing, Who is the Heir? This is pages 86 and 87. Let's see how Philo understands this promise to Abraham. He says, when the Lord led him outside, he says, look up into heaven and count the stars, if thou can count their sum. So shall be thy seed. Well, does the text say, so, not so many, that is, of equal number of the stars? For he wishes to suggest not number merely, but a multitude of other things, such as tend to happiness, perfect and complete. The seed shall be, he says, as the ethereal sight spread out before him, celestial as that is, full of light, unshadowed, and pure as that is, for night is banished from heaven, and darkness from ether. It shall be the very likeness of the stars. So, of course, he uses the term celestial here. This is me talking, by the way. This the term celestial, he capitalizes on this idea of light, not darkness, but light being pure, having darkness banished from heaven. And he says, it shall be the very likeness of the stars. So he clearly says, God is not just suggesting something numerical, but he's suggesting a multitude of other things. Now again, in this section here, when we're examining how this was understood in the Second Temple period, I'm not suggesting any of these writings are inspired. What I am suggesting is we can see how the Jews understood this during that time, during the time in between the Old and New Testament, and this is very significant because the New Testament authors read Second Temple period literature all the time. I mean, we see books like Enoch come up a number of times. We see a whole bunch of books alluded to, and some of them even quoted, like in the book of Jude, for example, or the letter of Jude. And so it's important when you have stuff that is found in Second Temple period literature, and then you have it come up in the New Testament, it's important to trace that back and figure out where it's coming from. And so, again, I'm not saying any of these interpretations are inspired or anything like that, but they're important for helping us to understand. Now, in another writing, in Questions and Answers on Genesis, Philo writes, "What is the meaning of the words, 'I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven'? Two things are indicated, in which the nature of all things in general consists, namely quantity and quality. Quality in 'I will multiply,' or quantity in 'I will multiply,' and quality in 'as the stars.'" So let's pause here real quick before we continue on. So he's saying that the promise has at least two understandings. You have a quality understanding and a quantity understanding. The quantity being how many there will be, right? Like the sand on the seashores. You'll have a ton of descendants. And then quality, on the other hand, as the stars, not just as many as the stars, which is actually added in to the NIV a couple of times, like in Genesis 26:4, they add the idea of a numerical concept there. You can read it if you want to. I would suggest going to Bible Hub and just looking at all the translations side by side. But that's actually not in the original text. It's added in because of the translator's understanding of this. So he says, as, not just as many as the stars, but also as the stars. So Philo goes on here. He says, "So may thy descendants be pure and far shining, and always be ranged in order and obey their leader, and may they behave like the luciform stars, which everywhere with the splendor of ethereal brightness also illumine all other things." So you can see he's clearly, he very clearly does not hold just the concept of a numerical understanding of this. Now let's look at the apocalypse of Abraham, and see how it's sort of understood here. This is going to be from the Apocalypse of Abraham, chapter 20, verses 3 through 5. It says, "Look from on high at the stars which are beneath you, and count them for me, and tell me their number. And I, Abraham, said, 'When can I? For I am a man.' And he said to me, 'As the number of the stars and their power, so shall I place for your seed.'" I sounded like Dr. Evil. "So shall I." So he says, as the number of stars and their power, so shall I place for your seed the nations and men set apart for me in my lot with Azazel. So notice in this writing, he says, well, I'm just a man. What can I do? And God, in the author of the Apocalypse of Abraham's understanding of this, says, no, you're going to be given power. You're going to be set aside for mere men. You're going to be with the stars in heaven. You're going to be given power. So clearly, this is understood, again, not as strictly numerical, but as having more meaning to it. This idea of power, which is tied to this idea of ruling the nations, which, of course, this is in more detail, an episode for another day, but we're going to replace the divine council. And we see things like in 1 Corinthians 6 that we're going to judge angels. We see things like in Revelation 3:21 that not only are we going to rule in some way, shape, or form, but we're going to sit on Christ's throne and rule with him. That's what he tells us. So you have this promise of the descendants of Abraham who are today Christian believers, anybody who trusts in Christ. You have this idea of ruling. You have this idea of power. You have this idea as more than just a vague number of people, but that there are promises that are being fulfilled. There are promises attached to this. And the question is, what is the one promise that God gave to Abraham? And of course, we see so far that maybe it's more than just numerical. Maybe there's a lot more to it, that the one promise is the inheritance of the cosmos, as we're going to see, becoming a father of many nations, the resurrection of the dead for those who are Abraham's offspring. So these are all tied. These are all tied in, seemingly, with the promise here. Now let's look at an excerpt from another Second Temple period writing. This is from Second Barak, not First Barak. That's the one in the Apocrypha. This is Second Barak. This is a different book. It's distinguished from the Barak you may have heard of if you're familiar with the Apocrypha. But this is from Second Barak, chapter 50, going into 51. He says, their splendor will be glorified in changes, and the appearance of their face will be turned into the light of their beauty, so that they may be able to acquire and receive the world which does not die, which is promised to them. When, therefore, they, speaking of the unrighteous, see that those over whom they are now exalted, who will then be exalted and glorified more than they will be transformed, the latter into the splendor of angels, and time will no longer age them. And they will dwell in the heights of that world, and they will be made like the angels. And listen to this. And they will be equal to the stars, and from light into the splendor of glory. And there will then be excellence in the righteous, surpassing that in angels. So remember, you could kind of see where some of the New Testament authors likely got their understanding of what glorification is going to look like, what the Eastern Orthodox would refer to as deification or theosis. What is it going to look like when we're given a new body in heaven, when we are transformed? So Barak here, or at least that's the name of the writing. It's not actually written by someone named Barak, but what he's pointing out here is that we will be made like the angels and even greater than the angels, but he takes angels and he uses it interchangeably with stars again. So we see the same concept again. The splendor of the angels is used synonymously with being made equal to the stars. And of course, you have, again, this idea of brightness and pureness and greatness in divinity. So this is clearly found here again in another Second Temple period writing. We will just look at one or two more, but you're going to see the same concept again. Let's just look at one more. If you've listened to this show before, you'll be familiar with, at least briefly, with the Book of Enoch or the Books of Enoch. So let's look at a passage from Enoch, and then we'll start to look at the Old Testament as well, at a couple places where this idea seems to be found, this idea of quality and not just quantity. And then we'll go and look at how Paul is using it and some very interesting things there. So this is from 1 Enoch chapter 104, verses 2 through 6. It says, "But now you shall shine like the lights of heaven, and you shall be seen, and the windows of heaven will be open to you, and you are about to be making a great rejoicing like the angels of heaven." So, again, same kind of concept here. You see this idea of the lights in heaven being used interchangeably with the angels of heaven. So this is clearly found here. And again, we just did an episode on this recently. I'll link it down in the description on how the Israelites used stars. And that's, if I remember correctly, that's almost strictly based on biblical passages. So passages that we see in Job or the Psalms or Deuteronomy. So check that out if you haven't. It will really help you understand what we're talking about here in regard to stars. But those are all biblical passages. So there's that. That's from 1 Enoch 104. So clearly we see some very prominent writings in the Second Temple period literature see this as more than quantitative and as qualitative. So This is not extensive, by the way. There are more writings, but let's back up a little bit now to the Old Testament and look at sort of a little bit of this concept. Again, check out that episode if you haven't. We're not going to cover right now all the passages regarding how the Israelites viewed stars, but we're just going to look at a couple that seem to apply here, and one that, very interestingly, from Jeremiah, one that definitely applies here. So this is from Daniel 12, verses 2 and 3. "Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven." Okay, so let's pause before we finish the verse. So this is Daniel 12, 2 and 3. We see this idea of those who... you'll have those who are going to awake to everlasting life, but then those who are going to have everlasting contempt. And again, this is a big verse that comes up in the annihilationist discussion as well. The everlasting life idea is that those who are saved, of course, are going to go off to everlasting life. Well, what is that going to look like for them? Well, those who have insight, those who have wisdom, they'll shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So you have this idea of a resurrection here. Okay, those who believe are going to be resurrected to new life, everlasting life. And those who are resurrected, they're going to shine like the brightness in the expanse of heaven. They're going to be like the stars forever and ever. So again, this is not only this not only demonstrates how they view the stars as we've seen elsewhere, but it ties in here because this is how they would view the resurrected believer, like the stars. Now let's look at Daniel 8, Daniel 8:10. It says it grew great even to the host of heaven. This, by the way, is a dream and a vision Daniel's having. But it grew great even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. So here again, and we'll touch on this again in a few minutes here, but if you just had this passage from Daniel, you'd say, oh, maybe, you know, it's a vision. Maybe they're just being metaphorical, of course, because he uses here the idea of the host of heaven and even the prince of the host of heaven interchangeably with stars. Okay, so again, we see this all over the Old Testament. We see it a number of times where the host of heaven, angelic beings, are used interchangeably with stars. And so if you just had this passage, you could try to make the argument that it's part of a vision or a dream, it's metaphorical. But the problem is, this is consistent throughout the Old Testament, and it's also consistent not only in Second Temple period literature, but it's consistent outside of Old Testament contemporary writings and even older writings from Israel's neighbors. And so when you have, if you're looking at the Bible objectively, and you have the Israelites not only not departing from this understanding of cosmology and the metaphysical realm, the spiritual realm, which is really intertwined with everything, especially in Old Testament thinking, when you have them not departing from their neighbors and also affirming things that their neighbors say, I see it as entirely disingenuous to try to just suggest that all of these references are metaphors. This is not how they viewed them. And I don't think there's any valid ground to say that this is how they viewed them. If they don't dispel it and rather they affirm it, and you're going to say, well, yeah, but this is special, and they're just using metaphors to try to keep with a certain particular view of inspiration, which isn't necessary. Even the Chicago Statement says that in regard to the inspiration of Scripture and the inerrancy of Scripture, that it's the truth propositions that are affirmed and that are inerrant. It doesn't mean that there's no error anywhere in the Bible in regard to anything. There's no claim in the Bible ever made like that. And so we have to be careful with that. But if you're looking objectively, we can understand better what the Israelites are communicating. And of course, how they understood the stars themselves does not change how we are going to be remade or transformed, rather. Transformed is a better word because, as we see in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, it's our bodies that are going to be renewed and transformed. So it's not necessarily that we're getting a new body, it's that our body will be made into something different. What's suggested here is that we will be made as the stars. And in this understanding, the stars are divine, they're pure, they're bright, they have power. So we see it tied with the resurrection. We see it tied with transformation. We see it tied with holiness or pureness. And these are all important terms for understanding what the authors are trying to communicate here, and especially once we arrive at the New Testament. So now let's look at Jeremiah 33. This is a very important passage here in regard to the understanding of being made as the stars in heaven. So here's another link that is undeniable. This is Jeremiah 33, 19 through 22. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. Thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day, my covenant with the night, so that day and night will not come at their appointed time, then also my covenant with David, my servant, may be broken so that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne, and my covenant with the Levitical priests, my ministers. Now listen to this. As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, and the sands of the sea cannot be measured, so I will multiply the seed of David my servant and the Levitical priests who minister to me. Notice that. Not only do you see this promise of multiplying David's seed with kingly power and priestly power in ministry, but you also see where Jeremiah is pulling from. He's pulling from the exact promise given to Abram. as the host of heaven cannot be numbered, and the sands of the sea cannot be measured. But do you notice the difference in Jeremiah's presentation of the promise to Abram and the original promise to Abram? The difference is that host of heaven is used here instead of stars. The host of heaven cannot be numbered. And the host of heaven is terminology used for spiritual beings, for God's angelic host, his angelic armies, his angelic family. This is used numerously throughout the Old Testament. So here we see Jeremiah using, he's totally comfortable using the term hosts of heaven interchangeably with stars. This is significant. It shows us that not only does Second Temple period writers view this way, but this is an inspired author of Scripture. Okay, this is Jeremiah from the Old Testament who clearly views the promise as something more than quantitative, something qualitative, and at the very least, something having to do with more than mere physical stars and the multiplication of the number of stars compared to the number of Abram's descendants or Abram's seed or his offspring. Clearly, he has a different and a further meaning in mind. Now, remember, in the Divine Council worldview, you have this concept of the nations being disinherited at Babel and placed under these lesser Elohim, these lesser quote-unquote gods. Again, the term gods is just an English translation of Elohim. It's used all over the Old Testament. But you have this concept found in Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9. We've covered it many times. But you have this sort of link here, this connection between the stars slash angelic beings, and on the other hand, them ruling the nations, them being tasked with being over the nations. And of course, they did so unjustly and became corrupt. But you have this link when it talks about us inheriting the cosmos, when it talks about us ruling the nations, when it talks about those who would be the offspring or the seed of Abram, as him as the father of the nations, us being given this benefit as well. You have this idea tied in with the Divine Council worldview and the Divine Council concept, that God has a Divine Council and we ultimately will replace that Divine Council. If you're an evangelical Christian, you already believe that in less words. You already believe that we're going to be glorified, that we're going to be given transformed bodies. Again, that we see in 2 Peter 1, that we're already partakers in the divine nature. Now, whatever that means, it can't mean nothing. It can't just be a throwaway phrase that Peter said accidentally. It has to mean something when Peter says, and ultimately God says, that we are partakers in the divine nature. And as we've seen, this promise would be more than just something that is temporary or just here on earth during our lifetime. It is something eternal. It is something bigger than this. Now, before we get to Paul here, let's look at one more Second Temple period writing again on this concept about the father of the nations idea and the stars idea. And this is going to be from Philo on the posterity of Cain. He says, "These boundaries were fixed not by the creation to which we belong, but on principles which are divine and are older than we in all that belongs to earth. This has been made clear by the law, where it solemnly enjoins upon each one of us not to adulterate the coinage of virtue using these words, 'Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's boundaries, which thy fathers set up.'" So pause. Notice he's using the term fathers here referring to angelic beings. He isn't just using it in reference to a physical human being. And he quotes Deuteronomy 19:14. He goes on and says, "And again, in other words, ask thy father, and he will show thee, thine elders, and they will tell thee. When the Most High distributed the nations, when he dispersed the sons of Adam, he set boundaries of nations according to the number of the angels of God. And Jacob, his people, became the Lord's portion. Israel became the lot of his inheritance." So he ties this all in to Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9, or here verses 7 through 9. So he talks about the boundaries of the nations that God had assigned. He had assigned the people in the nations to these angels of God or to these spiritual beings. And so we see his understanding here is the concept of the father of these nations in regard to ruling the nation is tied inexplicably to angels, to angelic beings. So that's very interesting. Now let's look at what Paul does with this. Let's go back to Romans 4, and we're going to start reading at, we'll start at verse 13. It was not through the law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be heir of the world, but through the righteousness that comes by faith. So again, this concept of heir of the world, this is the heir of the cosmos. Cosmos. Okay, this is much bigger than just a simple nation of Israel. He would be the heir of the world, but through the righteousness that comes by faith. For if those who depend on the law are heirs, faith means nothing and the promise is worthless, because the law brings wrath, and where there is no law, there is no transgression. Therefore, the promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring. Let's pause once more. Remember, this concept of the promise is really what we're talking about here. The promise is given to those who have faith, to those who trust in God, to those who trust ultimately in Christ. It's given freely to them. It's counted as righteousness, their faith. But what is the promise? And we've seen that the promise has to do with power. It has to do with inheritance. It has to do with becoming as the stars in heaven, being partakers of the divine nature. It has to do with the resurrection. There's a lot tied to this one promise. And it seems undeniable that this promise is not only quantitative, but also, of course, qualitative. So he goes on to say, let me just read verse 16 again. Therefore, the promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who have the faith of Abraham. He is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God, in whom he believed, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. So this, again, is the main passage from Paul that we're discussing here in the New Testament, where he takes Abraham's promise and he applies it. And this whole chapter 4 of Romans is about Abraham. So notice in this last part, when he says, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. Now, commentators will often understand this as Paul talking about God creating from ex nihilo. Now, it certainly is true that God created everything out of nothing. That's abundantly clear in writings like Colossians 1, for example, 15 and onward, that there is nothing that exists that Christ did not create, and he himself is not created. And so, of course, God did create everything from nothing. That's undeniable. But that doesn't really have anything to do with the context here. So this idea of God calling into being things that were not being a reference to creation from nothing, I mean, that would just kind of be random. It doesn't fit in with the context here. So when Paul says, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not, perhaps he's talking about transformation rather than literal physical creation. That would fit much better with the context and with the promise. Now, when we look back to 2 Barak once again, and remember, Barak wrote previously to Paul. He wrote in Second Temple period. And of course, Paul would have been very familiar with Barak, especially somebody like Paul, who's so well-versed in Hebrew and in Greek. And I mean, he was a Pharisee. He knew all of this. He would have been brilliant. Of course, you can see that in his writings. Even Peter says Paul's writings are difficult to understand sometimes. But if we look at where commentators often point in 2 Barak 21 and in 48, they again will try to say, well, you see the idea of God creating from ex nihilo here too. That's the point. It says, oh, you have made the earth. This is 2 Barak 21:4. Oh, you who have made the earth, hear me, and who has fixed the firmament by the word, and have set the sight of heaven in place of the Spirit, which has called from the beginning of the world things which did not previously exist, and they obey you. So notice he uses the same phrase that Paul uses. Okay, so he uses the same phrase, but you might have missed something. Right, you probably see the language about space here, about fixing the firmament in the height of heaven, and bringing into something things that don't exist. Now, you might hear this and think, well, of course, he's talking about creation. This is ex nihilo. But did you notice, again, like we see in Genesis 1, he says, "You who have made the earth, hear me, who has fixed the firmament by the word." Now, remember, what's the firmament? The firmament is the rakia in Hebrew. The firmament is the solid dome, which encompasses all that we see in space, at least in the Israelites' view. So, did you notice that term used here? Firmament. Well, the Israelites would have viewed, especially in Second Temple period literature, they would have viewed the heavenly firmament, the stars, as heavenly hosts, as angelic beings. Now, let's go on and look at what else... what else Barak has to say? So remember, it's the heavenly host that are going to obey God. He goes on in chapter 48 now, verses 8 through 10, and he says, "With signs and fear and indignation, you command the flames, and they change into spirits. And with a word, you bring to life that which does not exist. And with mighty power, you hold that which has not yet come. You instruct created things in your understanding, and you make wise the spheres so as to minister in their orders. Armies without number stand before you and minister in their orders quietly at your sign." So Barak here, who this isn't, I keep calling him Barak. This is a pseudepigraphical writing. This isn't actually written by a guy named Barak. They would often attribute their writings to well-known names, like Enoch, for example. It doesn't mean Enoch wrote it. They're not claiming that Enoch actually wrote it. It's just how they wrote. It's what they did. I mean, they had to call it something. So anyway, in Second Barak here, unknown guy, unknown name guy, uses the same language that Paul uses with bringing things into being that were not previously. And so we see how he uses it now in in chapter 48, that what he means by that is commanding angels, commanding spiritual beings. And now when we go back to Romans 4 and see the same language used by Paul, who is of course familiar with this writing, and we see he is our Father in the sight of God. Remember the Father being this idea, being tied with ruling, being tied with these spiritual beings who are set to rule, the sons of God in Deuteronomy 32, verse 8. So he says, "In whom he believed, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not." So again, we see the same concept of the angelic rule stuff tied in here. Now let's jump over to 1 Corinthians 15. And this is also very interesting. And this is going to be from 1 Corinthians 15. And if you're not familiar with 1 Corinthians 15, you need to be. It is the most important chapter in the Bible on the resurrection. I mean, if you want to defend the resurrection, if you're a Christian, you need to be able to defend the resurrection. But this is the place to go, 1 Corinthians 15. You have to be familiar with it. So in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 35 through 41, Paul says, in regard to the resurrection, our new resurrected bodies, he asks a question right here. "But someone will ask, how are the dead raised?" So that's a question. How are the dead raised? What's going to happen when we're raised from the dead? And he says, "With what kind of body do they come?" So this is the question he's responding to in the rest of this passage. "You foolish person, what you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain." And remember, Jesus used a similar analogy in regard to himself, that unless a kernel dies and falls to the ground, it'll just be one seed, but if it does that, then it's going to turn into many. So, interesting. But Paul goes on here, and he says, "But God gives it a body as he has chosen, and to each kind of seed its own body. For not all flesh is the same, but there is one kind for humans, another kind for animals, another for birds, and another for fish." So, before we get to verse 40 here, he's saying not all flesh is the same. There's a kind of flesh for animals, for birds, for fish, for humans. Okay, so he goes on to verse 40, and he says, "There are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is of one kind, and the glory of the earthly is of another. There is one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. For star differs from star in glory. So again, if we didn't just cover everything we just covered, you could look at this and say, well, this is just a metaphor, of course. I mean, stars are shiny, so he's just using this as a metaphor, as an analogy. And sure, I mean, you can take that view, but how are you going to explain away everything else we just talked about? How are you going to explain away the Old Testament understanding of how they viewed stars? How are you going to understand the Second Temple period understanding of how they viewed stars? Those things have to play a factor here. You have to be able to demonstrate how all of a sudden New Testament authors just changed their mind and they don't believe those things anymore. Yet nobody told us about this for 1500 years when they figured out what the solar system actually is. So you have a few analogies going on here. You have a seed becoming something greater than a bare seed. Okay. So of course, this same concept is true in glorification. You have this contrast between heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. And this idea in verse 41 is tied to the idea of glory. That's undeniable here. So you have, of course, the big picture concept of the resurrection and of glorification here. What is it going to be like when we're resurrected? So you have all these things tying together. And I don't think it's ironic. I don't think it's a coincidence that Paul chooses to use glory of heavenly bodies. Glory of how star differs from star. I don't think it's a coincidence that he's using this language. Now, I know that's a lot of information that we've covered so far, but think about it. Think about your own view in regard to this view. Maybe you'll end up holding this view. Maybe you won't. Maybe you have a good reason not to. Maybe you'll tweak your view somehow. But whatever it is, make sure you know your view, you understand your view, you can demonstrate your view, and you're convinced in your own heart of your view. Otherwise, there's no point in defending a view that you don't even believe and can't understand just because you've heard somebody else say it and you're supposed to think it or else they're going to think less of you. Remove that kind of thought. Look at the Bible objectively. And of course, if you have any questions, if you have any responses or disagreements or whatever, send them to information@apologetics.org. We're going to be doing our Q&A at the end of this month. So if you asked a question last month, don't worry, we still have that in the email. So we're going to respond to it at the end of this month on the last Friday of the month. So send your questions to information@apologetics.org. And otherwise, I hope you have something to think about now. I hope you have a blessed week, and we'll see you back here Tuesday night at 5 p.m. on the Universe Next Door.